Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton. And today, I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. In previous episodes, we've looked at what was going on with Disney in the 70s and mid-80s, in what is known as the Dark Ages. Dark because not only were they not at the top of the box office when it came to children's entertainment, but also because the material was jet black. Years previous had included movies like Something Wicked This Way Comes and Watcher in the Woods. But 1985 was the year of The Black Cauldron, which is a pretty spooky rewatch. This was a trend going on not only with Disney, but across the board with children's entertainment. And today we're going to look at two movies, one made by Disney, that upset children deeply in 1985, myself included. But first, why were these 80s movies for kids so dark, like across the board?
I think that the truth is it's just the way kids' movies were through most of that era. Because yeah. I think partially, if you look at the, you know, the 70s kids' movies that no one would ever watch ever again, like the Apple Dumpling Gang and stuff, like, I don't think that stuff connected as much and seemed as important to people. And I think it's 70s in general. 70s movies were gritty. So then going into the 80s, I also think, interestingly, somebody pointed out that a lot of franchises, and thinking about that, the respected one like Empire Strikes Back and Wrath of Khan were fairly recent, and that was like, mm-hmm. the stripped down gritty stuff was doing well. But I think all kids movies, like, we're talking about two that freaked kids out, but I mean, there's also this year, there's the Goonies, which freaked a lot of kids out. There's the
E.T.
So oh scary. For sure, yeah. Somebody, I can't even remember one of these movies. Oh, you know what it was, is Follow That Bird, which we'll get into. Part of it was they were like, we want a movie that younger kids can enjoy because they'd be too scared by E.T. But even, like, I think of Ewok's Battle for Endor. I'm pretty sure that movie starts with their family being slaughtered.
Yep.
Like, the humans don't survive. Like, those movies are nuts.
But then you're also getting out of something like The Dark Crystal, which we're going to reference today with Return to Oz, right? Where it's like, this was kind of the stuff that, so this is also, 1984 is the first year of PG-13. Yeah. And this is the following year after that. So, like, there is, like, this weird in-between zone of what is a PG movie. Like, Poltergeist is PG because they didn't have a PG-13.
Well, I also think that there's, like, it's, what we're seeing is the splitting of, which we've talked a bit about in the 70s, this splitting of audiences into children. And this what we're talking about today is very interesting because they're trying to hit a demographic which I think is not hit that often, which is like very young children. But yeah, it's this splitting of like separating your adults and your children and your teens. So like PG-13 was Spielberg, I think, you know, it's the Amblin stuff too, like trying to figure out that there's this group of kids with money who go to the movies all the time.
Well, it was Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Gremlins are the two that I believe maybe were before, or the Gremlins is the first, I think.
I think Temple of Doom is the catalyst for it, because they were trying to figure out how to do it. Yeah,
I did not like in Temple of Doom when I was little, and they ate the monkey.
Oh, yeah, I mean.
That is both very racist
and now we all know that it's very racist.
I really watched that when I was like way too young to see it. I think I was 3 or 4. It's a memory I have vividly. The reason being is that directly after we watched it, my mother made tomato soup for us, and myself and my two cousins who had watched it were just staring at this bowl waiting for the eyeballs to pop up, and she would not understand why we wouldn't eat anything. Eat tomato soup for years.
I feel like if you go to the classic Disney though too, it's like the kids were scared when Bambi's mother died.
Yeah.
You know, Sleeping
My
Beauty.
First theatrical experience was the re-release of Bambi.
Sure.
Which my grandmother took me to, and I do have a vivid memory of it, and I lost my shit. I went into full like hysterics when the mom dies, had to be like dragged out of the theater. Wasn't obviously no cell phones, so there was no one to pick us up. So it's just me in a movie theater for an hour and a half screaming and my poor grandmother. Like that, yeah. That is the, you know, that is the heritage of kids born in the 80s.
That actually happened to my sister as well. I went with my sister and one of my mom's friends took us to a movie, and it was the last movie she ever took us to because my sister cried the entire time and gently sat there saying, "Mama, Mama."
Yeah. Yeah, like I don't want to find out at such a young age that the ultimate villain is humans.
Yeah, sure. Yes, that the ultimate villain is humans. Yes.
Well, I think, and then we're going to see this in both of these films today, is like that. And what topics can children handle, right? Because I think we're going to look into Follow That Bird.
Yeah.
Is dealing with a very large topic that I don't know if it handles quite
right.
Oh,
I would say that I think both of these are I think we could say they're pushing a topic that is pushing topics that are incredibly complex.
Yeah.
And I don't think either of them quite nails it, which is part of their legacy.
And why you just feel so uncomfortable watching both of them, even as an adult, being like, oh, my God.
And I will say that I think that both of them are tackling thought so complicated, I don't know how you nail it. It's not like I can point to a movie
has
that
done it successfully.
Does it? Yes.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into Return to Oz because I know with both these movies, we got a lot to talk about today. So if you asked most North American kids who grew up in the 80s which movie spooked them the most, I am sure very many of them would say Return to Oz because this movie is wild. And I'm sure a lot of people have asked the question, why would Disney put forward this take on the Oz stories? Well, an Oscar-winning sound editing veteran and buddy of Spielberg and Lucas, Walter Murch, approached Disney for his directorial debut, a passion project he'd always had, to make a film version of the remaining Frank L. Baum Oz books he'd loved as a child. Now, Disney already owned the rights to most of the books, and Walter had already written the screenplay for The Black Stallion. So they paired him with a producer who knew their way around animatronics and puppets, Star Wars and Dark Crystal's Gary Kurtz, and in 1980 said, have at her, and thus returned to Oz. And then, like so many passion projects, it got weird. Cam, were you traumatized by this one as a child? Did you see this?
You know what? I don't think I saw it till a little later. The thing that was interesting to me is this movie was one that I had a bunch of stickers for it, and I never knew what they were, you know? So I liked TikTok, but I never really saw the movie till later in my life.
You didn't know the non-canonical Wizard of Oz characters from the
no,
books
you know what?
That the MGM film didn't focus
listen,
on?
Listen, if you want me to get into it, I will tell you that I feel like a big failure of this movie is it's not willing to commit to the trans narrative of Ozma of Oz, because I love the Oz books. But yeah, Mombi's whole thing is that she forces a girl to be a boy.
Yeah.
Magically. And the boy was Ozma all along. And the trans triumph in L. Frank Baum's literature is important.
Because this is two books mushed together.
Yes.
It's interesting to see what they choose and what they don't.
As much as I am an Oz fan, I can absolutely appreciate that you need to mush these two books if you want Dorothy in the Ozma stuff. And the Ozma stuff has all the cool guys like Jack Pumpkinhead, and TikTok is really good in it. So it's
the wheelies.
I get it. The wheelies.
Don't like it. Yeah. Don't like it. Nope.
And I believe both the Gnome King and Mombi are significant in it. So it's I get it. I kind of get it, but I do kind of hate that Ozma is her coolness is removed. But anyway, to quickly go through the plot of this, is you know, as confusing as an Oz thing usually is. Like most of them, Dorothy is now back in Kansas. We're more or less led to believe that this is the Dorothy, plot-wise at least, from the original film, because she's got ruby slippers and they send her back to Kansas and she lost them. Nobody believes her. She still thinks about Oz. She still kind of sees Oz. We are led to believe
that PTSD.
Yeah. Major PTSD. She maybe has psychosis.
But if Piper Laurie is involved at any point in your child rearing, you know there's an issue.
Well, I mean, there's your number one problem. Auntie M is now Piper Laurie.
Yeah.
I can appreciate Piper Laurie maybe wanting to take a nice role, but she does not come off great. But anyway, Auntie M doesn't know what to do. Dorothy's so bad at helping with chores. It's just weeks after the tornado too. Stuff is still kind of messed up. So she, to help Dorothy sleep, sends Dorothy to an institution which may be a little darker than it seems. I think to forgive Aunt M, she does not understand the horrors of electroshock therapy. But when Dorothy is about to be electroshocked, suddenly there's a storm. and a little girl helps her escape, a mysterious little girl. She gets swept away in a river and wakes up back in Oz with her favorite chicken, Bolina.
Voiced by Denise Beyer, who I think mm-hmm. most listeners would recognize as Hoggle and the Junk Lady mm-hmm. in Labyrinth.
Mm. A much more annoying voice than I thought. But yeah, so her and Bolina get into usual Oz trouble. It's like any Oz thing. It's a very episodic thing. She eventually meets TikTok, who is a wind-up soldier of Oz. All of the denizens of Oz, the Emerald City is destroyed. The denizens are all turned to stone. She understands that there's this guy, the Gnome King, who seems to be responsible. And she goes in searching for him in the hopes that he can restore Oz in the hopes that some sort of despot is a reasonable guy who will just listen to her. And yeah, so she teams up with TikTok, Jack Pumpkinhead, eventually a weird sled made out of the head of something called a gump and a couch.
It's like a moose.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think,
it's like
isn't
a green
the whole,
moose.
Like, contraption just called the gump? Like, it's not just the head, it's like a whole contraption.
Oh, I thought that the head was. I was like, who knows?
No, the whole. I mean, he refers to himself in the third person as a gump, but I mean, it's anyone's guess.
True. And it's kind of an interesting movie because there's like a boss and a sub boss, because the Gnome King is this big giant stone monster, but then also there's Princess Mombi, who's a creepy witch who can switch heads and really wants Dorothy's head.
The MGM version, you have where, you know, there's someone in Kansas who's a villain, mm-hmm. like Elvira Gulch, and then she, you know, the same actress portrays her, Margaret Hamilton, as the Wicked Witch of the West. Here we have like the evil nurse from this electric shop torture chamber is the real Princess Mombi.
And you also
and
the doctor is the Gnome King.
Yeah.
So, right. I didn't catch that. Thank you.
Her nurse is the head wheeler as well.
Yeah.
They're mm-hmm. all, I think it's the same. Interestingly, I see that credited to the movie, but I also, every play production I've seen does that.
Yeah.
All the people become the people. But yeah.
And the actress is also the evil queen from Willow, which traumatized me more as a child. I didn't grow up with this film, but Willow scared the hell out of me.
Yeah, Janet Marsh from Upstairs Downstairs, who
she's
then
great.
People figured out, you know who's a great evil witch? and she still looks like she'd play a great evil witch if you ever need one. But yeah, so it's a strange movie. But like, like Oz stuff, of course, you know, Dorothy triumphs.
It's interesting to me, though, because I mean, looking back on it, like, of course, everybody's familiar with the MGM version of it. That's like the definitive version. But there's versions before that as well, isn't there, mm-hmm. Alicia?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's like a dozen. This was, you know, obviously a story that was adapted almost from the beginning of narrative cinema. So as early as, you know, I think the first version would be there's two versions made in 1910. One survives, one does not. But the one that does survive is a Selig film called The Wonderful World of Oz. And it's made without Baum's permission because Baum went bankrupt in the 19 odds. And then basically the rights to The Wonderful World of Oz are auctioned off. And Selig buys them, makes that. There's a second one in 1910. There's The Patchwork Girl of Oz from 1914, which is a different book. That's my favorite. Mm. But the version that probably most people would know that predates the MGM is 1925's Larry Seaman version. The problem there, and maybe people don't know it, because I would really question whether this is screened in the last 10 years at any reputable film festival, silent or otherwise. It is one of the most racist depictions in silent films history. Unfortunately, even for at the time in 25, people were like, what the hell? Like, it's a god-awful film. And so I think a lot of these versions don't get screened. They're all, I will say, though, as nightmarish and surreal, if not more so, as the film we're talking about today. It is terrifying because you add this old timiness of like 1910s or 1920s jankiness, add it to these characters in the story, and it's total nightmare fuel.
Oh,
books are inherently frightening, though. And even the MGM one, I know my mom talking about when she first saw that when she was a little girl, she said the legs underneath curling up scared the crap out of her.
Like, the flying monkeys, I feel like, are a famous
flying monkeys terrifying
everybody thing. Yeah.
The and, death I mean, scene, too. Scary for little kids. Oh, I'm melting. Come on. Yeah.
It's also one that is like, it did good when it came out, but it's kind of a fascinating one because it was a big television one where it would play like every Thanksgiving And so people could, there was a low barrier to entry for the MGM one. And it's interesting because Disney bought the rights to the rest of the catalog quite soon after it, and actually developed something called the Rainbow Road to Oz. But they balked because they got a little fearful for how classic the original was becoming due to television.
I think that's a great point, Cam, because it's often a misconception, because of course Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz are both released in 1939 from the same studio, MGM. Both at one point had Victor Fleming directing, and it's really important to point out that basically Wizard of Oz failed commercially in 1939 upon its release. It wasn't until a decade later, when it was re-released in theaters in 1949, that MGM recouped a lot of its money. And a lot of that is because Judy Garland's stardom had evolved so much in that decade that people were going back to watch this film that ultimately, I mean, even reading some of the reviews, like in Variety, this was not a film people liked. And the budget was enormous. And we all know, mythology and the stories of actors, you know, getting lead poisoning. And it's a very troubled production. And then, we're a great generation in terms of the kids who born in the 80s who grew up with this on television and in the home market. Having this on VHS was a big deal. I don't think that was the case for generations before us.
Well, that makes sense then for Disney to greenlight a sequel. Now, this development process took a long time, especially because I think this was like 1980 is when they started the production. At this point, of course, Walter Murch was enormous from like working on like Apocalypse Now, like big buddy of like Coppola and
also edited Captain EO.
Yes, you are correct. Sure. That is right. But that would be a tough project.
When you think about it, Google Images of Captain EO, there is a lot of imagery from Captain EO that makes its way into this.
Sure. Okay, that makes sense. Sure. So they get the big opening thing of they're like, okay, you can try your hand at it. But Walter Murch, it needs to be clear, defends this movie to the end. This is exactly what he thinks it should be. He doesn't understand why people think this is. He has ideas of why people think it's frightening, but he thinks they're wrong. So that's interesting. But the biggest thing he thinks people don't like about this movie is it's not a musical. He thinks everyone
I disagree.
Came in. Wanted, it, agreed. But it's, could you ever make anything that can compete? Do you know what I mean?
I agree with him, though, that I think he would have been able to get away with the plot that he has a lot easier if it was a musical.
But The Wiz is really scary. Like, The Wiz is a musical, and we did that on the podcast,
I think The Wiz is crazier than this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of the scares in this are not that wild.
But I don't think The Wiz is meant for kids. The Wiz is for adults, right? It's the intended audience.
Yeah, I mean, The Wiz is weird because it's, full adults doing stuff and telling adult jokes and things.
Yeah, we have a 38-year-old Dorothy in that film, and then we have a nine or ten, which is the age that she is in the books. Like when Judy Garland played her at 15, 16, that was a complete
was a big thing that Walter Murch wanted,
and that's apparently the other thing he said is he's like, I think that's the reason why a lot more people were really upset by it is because she's so young. And Farrugia Balk, we should say this is Farrugia Balk's like not her first role. She'd actually been in film and television like since she was like 3 or something like that, but she is excellent in this. And so she's doing all of her own stunts at 9, including the water stuff, including the stuff where they harness her up and drop her. Like, it's wild when you watch all the behind the scenes footage, because there's one scene where like they drop her and she lands in the thing and she goes, "Do we have to do it again?"
That was a bit sad.
And one of the stunt guy
say.
Comes over, he's like, "No, baby, you're done." And "Oh man."
It's interesting. And I mean, it's very interesting because obviously Farrugia Balk went on to be like famous for being kind of the bad girl, and to see her play like just an innocent so well. And I think she also like it sublimates the Judy Garland Dorothy a bit in her performance in a way that nobody else is really trying too hard to be that.
She's also not twee.
Really well.
I think that's the other thing is she plays like she's not annoying, and you believe like this, unlike Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, which we discussed last season, you believe she's capable of being a badass. Whereas those kids, don't believe they can do it.
Yeah.
What I also get from her is this harkens back to an earlier point, but that PTSD, that true tear, that psychosis is there in her character. And as much as I think, young audience members will be terrified of some of the elements of this film, I get that from Farrugia Balk's performance, that she is equally terrified. And it's just so different than Judy Garland, who's sort of, upset when the monkeys carry her off or whatever. It was just, like, this is true terror. This is true uncontrollable, uncontestable hellscape that she finds herself in. And there's no singing. There's no yellow brick road. There's no technicolor. Yeah. There's no fluffiness.
Well, and everything we loved is destroyed. Like the minute you get to Oz, there's nothing there for her.
And even with, everything she, and all of, you know, the lion, the tin men, these are all turned to stone. It's very, actually C.S. Lewis, to come back to Narnia. But also, like, things in Kansas are not good. Like, they're going to lose the house because they've over-mortgaged it and they don't have the money to fix it. And even, like, her uncle is, like, has elements of PTSD. Mm. Like, it, just her life is about what you would expect from, you know, a rural Kansas orphan being raised by elderly aunt and uncle who are economically, you know, at the bottom of the pile.
It's worth saying Walter Murch, again, in one of his crazy things, said he was heavily inspired by the book Wisconsin Death Trip, which if you've read and seen it is like just depressing photos of Wisconsin. And there's a great documentary of it that comes and goes out of Wright's hell.
So,
but yeah, it's weird. And then he also shot it with the gentleman who would go on to win an Oscar this year for Out of Africa, which is kind of wild. So it's like a very drab, miserable looking place in Oz. And it becomes this weird thing where she's, unlike the last film where it was all about trying to get home, this one is her being very torn between wanting to stay in Oz and dealing with the realities of home.
And he talks about it, that this being about defending your dreams in the face of everything. And I'm like, is it? Is that what this is about? It sounds like he was having some issues as well at the time. So like we mentioned, this was a long development process. It got taken away from him a couple times and give it back. Then when he was going like, I think some like $10 or $15 million over budget on paper at one point. So they brought in Paul Maslansky, who I guess was known for the Police Academy series of movies.
Mm-hmm. The reputable franchise.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably cheap.
Exactly. It was cheap and I'm sure made a ton of money. So he showed up and managed to like cut the budget way down. And that's when Gary Kurtz left the project, who was who had worked a bunch on Star Wars and Dark Crystal, et cetera. But he talks about how he knew something was wrong when they started filming the scenes in the institution and how dark everything was. And seeing the machine that they were going to hook Dorothy up to. He's like, this is where the red flag started going off for me. And then apparently Walter Murch also just got so overwhelmed by the directorial duties that like by day one or by day three, they were 5 days over the shoot time already.
Yeah. So I think it's worth saying that I do think that the end product is pretty amazing.
Agreed.
And like the effects are amazing and it looks great. But when you hear, number one, you hear even Roy Disney in interviews say that the big problem that Disney had at the moment was things were going way over schedule and way over budget.
Yeah.
And when you read about the development of this film, it was actually a lot more ambitious than it came out. So like it was going to be shot in Algeria and Italy and I think America, and it ended up just being shot in England. If you look at the stars, like there's nothing wrong with the cast. I think everyone in the cast does a great job, but like the Gnome King was offered to Christopher Lloyd and Tim Curry. Princess Mombi was like Louise Fletcher, Terry Garr, and Mary Steenburgen.
Oh, man.
Dick Van Dyke was apparently approached for Jack's Pumpkinhead or the Scarecrow.
Wow.
So it's like, yeah, they obviously were doing cuts all over the place, because this is mostly actors you would not know outside of like British theater and television. I don't know.
It feels like they just got frustrated with it at a certain point in its development stage. And they had this property that they kind of had to go forward with because the rights were going to lapse and it was going to go into public domain. And this was, and it actually did by the time it was 1985, but they had to put the Disney stamp finally on The Wizard of Oz so they could have it in the future, which comes in handy when you're doing, for instance, the Muppet version of Wizard of Oz, because they can still come back to the original. I did find it really interesting that, and I don't know if they knew they would have to do this at the time, but in order to use the ruby red slippers as part of the story, they had to actually pay an enormous fee to MGM, because that was an element that MGM put into the story that was never there in Baum's original. It's silver shoes and they kind of have different powers. Here you see that sort of distilled in one of the belts or something like that in this version.
Yeah.
But and you know, these shoes, which I love that Fairuza Balk kind of only recently at a convention mentioned she does still have the one pair. There was like two pairs made. She has one. That makes me so happy. But that element of just blending, you know, nearly a century, just shy of a century of popular cultural conceptions of this tale is I think fascinating. I don't think I like this film. I never grew up with it, but I actually respect this film. I watched it last night and was like, damn, like to go that dark, to go that depraved and subversive and surreal as a Disney film. It reminds me a lot of like Something Wicked This Way Comes, which you brought up, Becky. Sure. I applaud this because we know what comes after. Yeah. And I was very terrified in the Mombi sequence with all the moving heads. Like that is...
Yeah, yeah.
May I say that it occurred to me, and this was kind of inspired by something I read, and it made my mind sort of spin, but I was thinking about my favorite adaptations of Wizard of Oz that aren't really Wizard of Oz, and I think one of the ultimate is Wild at Heart, mm-hmm. David Lynch's film. To me, do you think David Lynch was watching this movie when he made Mulholland Drive? Because there is a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of Mulholland Drive here.
I think that there's a lot of, stuff that people took for other things. I mean, I'm also fascinated. I know, Becky, you'd briefly considered maybe putting a highlight on Will Vinton's Tales of Mark Twain, mm-hmm. and he does all the Gnome King stuff here, and it reminds me of that weird Satan sequence.
It's the same year, man.
And it's the same style of creepy face animation, like really terrifying stop motion stuff. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of inspiration. I think the real problem with the film to me is it's real slow. Considering it's a lot of fun stuff happening, each sequence is like, and it's wild from Walter Murch, who's like famous for editing. I mean, we studied in school. He and Michael Ondaatje have a wonderful book together where they talk about editing The English Patient, because he famously swooped in and saved that movie from not functioning at all. So
he also re-edited Touch of Evil to Orson Welles's specifications long after Orson Welles had died. And that is like when you watch Touch of Evil today, which is currently on Hollywood Suite, that is the version that you watch. It's the approved version. The only version that Orson Welles would have ever wanted anyone to see without studio interference was redone by Walter Murch in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. And I also like the fact that, it does sound like it was a very miserable experience for him. And I think like some people you hear, it's not that he never went on to direct because this killed his career. He just went like, nope, I don't like that.
But it's also, I think like the special effects in this are amazing. They still look fantastic. Yes. Like the mobbing heads works. And that's why, like, it's not cheesy. It's just scary.
And I think it's crazy limitations too. Cause I mean, you have some like half robotic, half not. And I mean, the other thing to think with all these special effects is for the craziest special effect they have is a child of that age who can only work 3.5 hours a day. Who's in almost every scene, so that's also a bizarre limitation. But they did so much, and each of the puppets, like TikTok and Pumpkinhead Jack, neither of these are a person in a suit. These are like crazy elaborate effects, so it does really hold up in that regard. And you kind of do, I don't know, and I definitely never fault anyone going for Oz, because it's like Oz is the like now mostly public domain franchise that nobody has properly exploited.
But also no one can figure out what to do with it. I think that's the biggest issue. So like there's like the one, Alicia, I think you were just about to bring up, which is the one with James, what's his namey, who we shall not speak of. Yes.
Oh, yes.
You know, that one.
We still have to say his name so people know what we're talking about.
And I mean, like the new, the one with Elf about
the great
Wicked
and powerful
is,
Oz is the one you mean.
Wicked is coming out. That's a big property that's coming out in the musical version for film. Like, so I think that's the closest anyone's figured it out, but that is for adults. Like even the book is for adults. It's
and,
not
and
for children.
There's the Muppet version. The Muppet version, I have to say, is pretty good.
Of course you love the Muppet version.
And there's a version I haven't seen, but I'm not sure if we're familiar with this. 1972, I believe it's called Journey to Oz with Liza Minnelli. I mean, why not, right?
Well, that makes all the sense in the world.
It's a huge animated ripoff of Robin Hood because, like, the lion looks the same. Although, what year is Robin Hood?
I think it's like 82.
That will be next on my list.
It's like 82 or 83.
I will say that if you guys want a bonkers one, a favorite of the podcast, Tarsem Singh, tried a gritty television reboot called Emerald City. Which
now, that's
actually
the guy who could have done it.
I think he didn't quite have the budget he needed, but Vincent D'Onofrio is the wizard. Trans Ozma.
Good.
So like it cued close to the books, but it was a bit of an insane.
Like MGM has just sort of ruined the story for us. I mean, that seems so insane to say, because what a canonical, classic, most beloved film of all time, Wizard of Oz. But it ruined Baum's, I think, original story by distilling it too much, by omitting so much that now we can't accept anything else.
Well, and sanitizing is the other thing, right? Because you can't think of it as anything but like Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Like that, how do you, and everyone will be like, you've made the gritty version. And you're like, it is the gritty version. The original version is the gritty version.
Sometimes home sucks. Yeah. Like, there's no place at home. I'm sorry. Look at Dorothy's home. Why are you trying to go back there?
Well, I think the thing is, in 19, oh, whatever, probably being at a farm was nice. But now we're all like, ugh, a farm. There's nothing here for you. Love of a family. Yeah, I don't know. It's tough because it's like, I respect this for not wanting to acknowledge the old one, but I do think it might have just done better if you paid for more than the ruby slippers and just kind of went with it.
The Muppets acknowledged the 39 version in a very appropriate way.
Oh, good. So what you're saying is people should go watch the Muppet version, but are you recommending people watch this one? Do you think people should?
Oh, boy. I would advise parents to think long and hard if this is appropriate for children under the age of 10.
My small person is 8, and my small person, I showed them pictures and they went, I'm good.
No,
I'm good
you.
For now. they were fascinated. This is interesting. And I think this also leads into Walter Murch talking about how he had loved these stories when he was 5 or 6. And when I was telling my partner about some of the stuff that happens in this that I had forgotten had happened, my little person was listening in and they were like, this sounds incredibly cool. Can you tell me more about this and can I watch it? So I think there's something about the imagination versus the reality of it that makes it something totally different.
I also wonder if you just skipped the opening, you know, just have it be in Oz. I know people find the Wheelers very scary, but they're a little goofy too if you just sit with them.
Yeah, I almost wonder if like the kids who love Nightmare Before Christmas would love this, because of course Jack Skellington, Tim Burton has talked about how Jack Skellington was inspired by Pumpkinhead. But you know, if you have one of those little macabre kids like I was running around, you know, obsessed with Victorian culture, maybe they'll love this. Maybe. I would definitely want to have a conversation about how we don't electroshock humans anymore.
We do.
Oh, we do. Actually, it's back, baby.
We figured out how to do it. Yes.
We don't willy-nilly electroshock people for fun.
Do we do that to children?
I don't think so. Maybe. I don't think so. I don't know. I'm not a medical professional. Do not take this as medical advice.
I just know that it has come back into favor for certain treatments.
That is correct. All right. On that note, shall we talk about a movie intended for very, very small children, which is also about home and family? That's Follow That Bird, coming up after the break. For our second movie today, we're looking at a debut feature for someone who is recognizable across the planet. He's got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and you definitely notice him on the street because he's 8'2". He's one big bird. In fact, he's Big Bird. And in 1985, he left his home on Sesame Street to be with his new family, and producers hoped that a big bird would mean big box office. We're going to find out how that turned out. It's a movie, according to my mother, I saw when I was 3 and was inconsolable at the sight of a big bird in a cage. Alicia, I know this one is meaningful for you as well, so let's follow that bird.
Yes, let's follow that bird into utter despair.
Yeah, so sad. Oh, God.
The reason this is so special is because I watched it all the time. I wore out that, it was probably Beta, really, or maybe I taped it off television. I wore out that tape pretty quickly, probably multiple tapes. I watched this all the time as a kid, which watching it as an adult, as a, you know, woman sliding into 40, I cannot imagine what appealed to me as a child, because it was so, I mean, I do know I've loved Sesame Street like every kid. I loved it so much, but like it's very terrifying. It's very upsetting. I felt re-traumatized from like 35 years ago, just watching Big Bird in a cage, and he turns blue and he's crying and he's locked up, kind of in a Pinocchio vibe, you know, when they take Pinocchio to the it's not good. Stromboli, is it I can't remember who does
It's Stromboli. But
the story of this is it's 1985, and this is going to be the first kind of Sesame Street feature film, and it remains the first Sesame Street theatrical feature film for many, many years until Elmo and Grouchland, which I think is the late 90s. And this is a film that was really kind of conceptualized as bringing the world of Sesame Street and expanding it specifically to Toronto, where it's filmed in thereabouts. I will talk more about that in a second, but because I think it's really fascinating. So we have a situation where there's this board called the Feathered Friends Board of Birds. Awful. I guess they're supposed to mean well, but they realize that there's this bird living in New York City on Sesame Street that is without other birds. And so they try to like coax him away from his Sesame Street family and place him with the Dodos, a family of birds in Illinois who are, they're not abusive. They're just bad. They're just dum-dums.
They're dum-dums and they're just a really bad fit and they don't listen. And I think that development of those characters is so smart because how else would you make it so that they're not abusive, but they're not a good fit?
And Big Bird realizes they're not a good fit when they kind of encourage him to not think of Snuffleupagus as his best friend anymore and that he should only be associating with birds and not associating with people and other monsters and, you know, a green monster that lives in a garbage can and things like that. And he runs away. And the thing about Big Bird is you have to remember he's a six-year-old, like, and he has the mind of a six-year-old. And running away is perilous, and he gets caught up with SCTV people, although they're not playing SCTV people, but they basically are SCTV people, and they lock him up in a circus and they turn him into a sideshow, and then all of Sesame Street finds this out from the news, and they go after and they find him because he's family, and they go to find him so they can bring him back to his home, his real home, and his family and his nest and Snuffy and his, you know, Radar, his teddy bears along for the ride. I'd forgotten about Radar entirely, that Big Bird had a teddy. I'd forgotten that Oscar the Grouch is carried around by a trash man that's also performed by also Bruno.
In my books, I noticed a lot of characters from the books. Bruno and the main kind of antagonist, she would show up now and again because there wasn't really Sesame Street antagonists. So
Miss Finch,
she's
scary. Like I remember her really frightening.
Because her eyebrows go angry.
It's because she's voiced by Sally Kellerman. This film has a lot of Brewster McCloud vibes.
Sure.
Please, the best double bill I can ever think of in my little curatorial brain is Follow That Bird, followed by Brewster McCloud. both of them have, both of them about big giant birds. Both of them have Sally Kellerman. Both of them are road movies. Mm-hmm. Please, somebody give me a stage so I can do these
downbeat weird. Yeah.
All right, so we should say this movie was a massive failure at the box office.
Not massive.
It was pretty bad.
No, Becky.
It was bad.
No, I mean only if you want to quadruple your profits.
If you're Hollywood, it's considered a flop.
It made a ton of money on the home video circuit, which is where it would, because like if you're taking like a 3-year-old to the theater, you're a nut, right? Like, but it's also opening again, so it opened the same weekend as Weird Science and Fright Night and Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Back to the Future, and
so
the Black Cauldron were still on screen, and they had just reissued E.T., Gremlins, and Ghostbusters. So it's like if you're taking your kids into something that you also want to sit in, like there's just like a saleability issue there, right?
I mean, it's also just, I think it's what they aimed at, you know, the Sesame Street main audience is not an audience that is often marketed to. You know, it's the Oogie Loves and the Big Balloon Adventure. It's not a movie that most parents want to sit through, even though I do think that this movie does a fair job catering to parents. And almost, if anything,
there's really good jokes in here.
Agreed.
Yeah. If anything, I think the jokes are not like there aren't enough stuff that would delight a kid. You know, I know the kids obviously just love seeing Muppets do things and stuff, but I kind of wonder if there's enough of that chaotic kind of silly energy that children enjoy.
And I think that I'm actually with you, Cam. And I think part of the issue is because of the theme of this movie and what they're dealing with, which is like chosen family, as well as ideas of segregation and stuff like that. It's like,
that's true.
These are...
The segregation is just kind of touched
on. It is, but like they keep talking about your own kind. And that is big hot button thing. You know, it's interesting.
I think something we kind of forget about Sesame Street is like from its inception in 1969 that it was doing remarkable things, subversive things that no one had ever done before around children and these issues. And, you know, thinking about like, well, Sesame Street didn't kill off Mr. Hooper, but the actor who played Mr. Hooper died. And I don't think any other TV show would have actually shown Big Bird being told that Mr. Hooper wasn't coming back the next day and trying to make Big Bird and his friends understand death.
Well, they often used Big Bird for those things because Big Bird is 6 years old. So Big Bird is approximately the same age as these children,
right? He was conceptualized as the sounding board, right, for that child audience. I don't know. Like, I think this film, I really applaud this film for taking on what it does. I agree with both of you. I don't think it's 100% successful, but I think it's more successful than not.
Mm.
In that, agreed. Like, when they find him, when they rescue him and he's brought back to Sesame Street, and I, as an adult, same as I did as a child, feel such incredible relief and such love and such comfort. And with the possible exception of the two men who put him in the cage, which are Joe Flaherty and Dave Thomas, there's no real villain here other than circumstance, other than also social forces. Like, this is a social worker coming in and taking a child out of an urban setting, the only setting that he knows, and putting him in this, like, ridiculous suburban, very and white, that, monolithic.
It's interesting because that was a last-minute change, too. The original shooting script actually involved the rest of the board coming and seeing Sesame Street and keeping her kind of the villain, Miss Finch. And they decided that it was better to make her realize it herself so that there was no real villains. And I mean, you even get to see that Joe Flaherty and Dave Thomas are on hard times. They just need anything to save their fun fair.
In fairness to, like, Joe Flaherty's character, when Big Bird sings, so he turns blue out of sadness. It is one of the most traumatic things I've ever seen in a children's film. And he sings this incredible
song. He's painted
song.
Blue, isn't he?
Did they paint him
blue? They painted him blue
because he's the blue bird of happiness.
To hide him.
But why does he have blue tears then, Cam?
Because I think the paint gets in it.
Because the paint's running. Yes, that's why.
No, I think he turned blue from sadness. Okay. He might have also been painted. But I'm just saying, when he sings, you know, that song, it's even Joe Flaherty, who's like holding the kind of the spotlight on him, starts bawling his eyes out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think they make Joe Flaherty just like the dumb goon. He's not mean. He's just dumb. I mean, he's like Cookie Monster. He has the cookies. Yeah, Dave Thomas is bad.
I am not the only one who has pointed this out. This is a very similar premise to the Muppet movie. So then the question becomes, like, did they think that this was, like, they would just translate the one format to the other?
I heard a great thing, because you kind of were like, why, you know, and why is Pee-wee like this? Why do things expand into a road movie like this? And I saw a great commentary on it, credited to Unknown, which is that road movies are existential films. So they're saying that if you want to expand a character, it's exploring that character. By putting something on the road instead of a fixed setting, you are focusing directly on the character. But then they also, obviously, it's easy then to make a bunch of vignettes, as this movie is and as the Muppets are, and silly cameos.
It makes sense why someone would only be in the film for two minutes.
Yes. It's also great for puppets and stuff, because you could just do different setups and get in and out.
it's Muppet 101. I mean, sure, this is just like the Muppet movie. It's a different goal, even though the Muppets really do realize that they've always had each other the whole time, and that's what home is. But, you know, then you just transport that Muppet movie to London, and it's the Great Muppet Caper. Then you transport it to Manhattan, and it's the Muppets Take Manhattan. Like, you just,
which Manhattan is the year before this, which is my favorite Muppet movie of all time.
It's so good. You got the diner run by rats. It doesn't get better than that.
I don't think there's a movie that's more influential.
Better than a Grouch diner run by Paul Bartel and Sandra Bernhardt.
Okay, do kids love Paul Bartel?
I loved the sequence. So this is where I think Follow That Bird is really successful, is I, as an adult, laughed quite a bit. And it's not cheap laughs. Like, it's really endearing. And, you know, Oscar seeing this, like, roads, it's called the Don't Drop In, you know, hotel and, like, diner. And he kind of pops his head in. There's all these, like, this food fight with Paul Bartel and all of these other grouches, including Grungetta, which is his, like, girlfriend.
And Sandra Bernhardt.
Grumpy
Sandra Bernhardt.
I mean, in researching this and digging hard, because number one, the thing that shocked me that I guess I never understood watching Sesame Street is that Oscar the Grouch is in love with Maria, which I did not get.
He calls her skinny.
And he goes at one point, an angry face in a beautiful place when they're in a junkyard. but I love to see that apparently cut from it was Oscar the Grouch saying a love song to Maria when their tire blew out and she was like covered in dirt and destroyed. He's saying,
want to see that answer.
I know. I don't think they shot it even. I think it was cut before they shot. But yes, there was meant to be even more focus on Oscar as Maria gets more and more beat down, falling in love with her more and more.
Can we just say that somehow all of these Muppet characters have the sweetest rides?
Oh, I mean, it's also like a wacky races.
This puts Muppets in a biplane.
Yeah, Mad World. Yeah. Vibes. I mean, I love, even though it's a regular car, I love Cookie Monster slowly eating the car that Gordon has.
He eats all the leather seats. I love the Count's incredible like Transylvanian coupe. I love that we have Bernie and Ert. Oh my God. Ernie. Don't cut that out. Bernie and Ert.
Yes.
Ernie and Bert in a biplane flying upside down, which had Frank Oz and Jim Henson actually mastering, you know, every like Muppet movie.
Yes.
I think it's Muppets Take Manhattan where they ride the bikes and like that was a huge
which
Muppet.
Is sorcery. Yes. I don't know how they do it
exactly. They always challenge themselves with everyone. Was it Muppets Take Manhattan or was it London? I can't remember.
Manhattan, because they're going around Central Park.
I think it's two of them, but anyway, well, we see Kermit on a bike standing on a bike
and him in the swamp in the first one is also famously tough.
So there's always a challenge, right? And this challenge puts this North by Northwest like Hitchcock sequence and puts it in the laps of Ernie and Bert, and they're, you know, going twirling around in this plane. It's wonderful. It's also the last feature film performance of Jim Henson as Ernie, obviously, because there's only been one, but also as Kermit.
Yeah.
Kermit's a reporter in this, so it's, you know, he would do it again. Like, you know, he dies in 1990, so there's the opportunities in that 5 years. But in terms of something on the big screen, this is the last one.
I'll also say, as a I don't have a ton of Sesame Street history, but this is also an interesting point in Sesame Street, because this is right before 1985 was when they decided to no longer make Snuffleupagus imaginary, because they got worried about children being groomed by pedophiles and lying, so they wanted to encourage children to tell the truth.
And not being believed by adults, that when you tell adults something that they don't believe you.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting to see that side of Snuffleupagus still on screen, because you're like, no, Snuffy.
yeah. Snuffy. Do you remember Snuffy? Like Alice? Wasn't there his little sister Alice?
Oh, yes.
As well?
With the big eyes.
I think so.
Because I kind of sense that Alice might have been real, but Snuffy wasn't, which is very confusing.
Yeah. I
think Alice came along later.
Yes,
that's
and
why. Along
by the time Snuffy was real.
Alice doesn't live here anymore.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, yeah, seeing all the members of the street and stuff is so crazy, like, and ones that you haven't seen in a while.
It just touched me so much to see a lot of forgotten Muppets that deserve, sure. And you also see a very early
Tully. Lots of Tully.
Tully. Oh, I love Tully. Tully's the best. Okay, so we need to talk about the Toronto connection here, because they rebuilt Sesame Street in a larger form in a studio in Toronto. I believe Toronto Studios is where they built it. But what were they doing in Toronto, Alicia? You know this. You're like Muppet experts.
They'd never left Toronto. I mean, Jim Henson's relationship to Toronto goes back to the late 1960s when he filmed Hey Cinderella, which is a Cinderella story starring Kermit, technically Kermit's first feature film, here in Yorkville in 1969. And from then on, he developed kind of a relationship with the CBC and a lot of Toronto studios and Toronto artists and writers. And a lot of the productions that we kind of forget about in the Muppet Kingdom are Toronto. Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, 1977. We're recording this in the Annex, filmed down the street. Fraggle Rock, during 1985, would have been filmed here in Toronto, in Yorkville. It's a CBC, HBO co-production. So you have a lot of the Fraggle transports, kind of like people transplanted from the set of Fraggle Rock to this film, which makes perfect sense. So there was never a point really in the Toronto relationship predates the Muppet Show. In fact, the Muppet Show at a certain point, the 70s version, was going to be filmed in Toronto. It ended up in the UK for funding reasons, for broadcast reasons, something. But we were originally going to have that as a show produced here. Mm. So Follow That Bird, I mean, I think one of my favorite Muppet productions ever is Muppet Family Christmas, is where you have the Sesame Street, including Big Bird, where the chef tries to cook him for Christmas. In retrospect, that is very upsetting. Sesame Street
just don't
meets
think about
the Muppets meets Fraggle Rock blows my mind. That's filmed in like Collingwood or Kleinberg. Mm. So there was always Toronto. And what it's interesting, because there's other Toronto connections. where you have like the Animation House Limited, who did the animated sequence that opens this film.
Oh yeah, very cool animated sequences, worth saying.
Very cool. It ended up being bought by Anne Murray, and then she like closed it in 2002, which kind of broke my heart a little bit. But and then you also have I love the idea of how many Muppeteers were in Toronto from the 70s and 80s, because you do hear stories about people kind of going to the Pilot, which is a bar that still exists in Yorkville, after work. And under the table, if you looked really closely, you would just see people's bags with Muppet legs like, sticking out and like Muppet clothes. But, you know, it makes sense that he would film it here. It's not a Canadian film. I don't want to give anyone that, you know, misconception. Although there are major Canadian artists on this, including Carol Spear. And if anyone, maybe people are not familiar with the name Carol Spear, Carol Spear was the art director on this film. So she would have been filming this while prepping The Fly. She's Cronenberg's art director of choice, still is, has worked with Cronenberg for almost the entirety of his career. And then when she's not working with Cronenberg, she's doing The Muppets. She did The Muppet Family Christmas. Same with Eleanor Rose Galbraith, who is the set decorator on this film, goes on to The Fly, goes on to Dead Ringers. Here's my question. How do you do a film like this while also keeping Dead Ringers in your mind?
Oh, yeah.
Because of the deep complication of both of those things. Like, this is an incredibly gorgeously designed set, right? Like, Sesame Street is real. It looks amazing. Yeah. So does The Grouch Diner. Like, all of it's incredible. Dead Ringers and The Fly look amazing. They are both incredible set decorations. Like, it's just someone who's very good at their job.
Cronenberg and Muppetdom, in terms of a Canadian context, are on parallel
tracks. Oh, and I mean, it's also, like, probably, that seems like a cakewalk. Once you don't involve Muppets, if I know anything about the puppets, once you're not dealing with that, it's great. And I think it's worth saying as well that this is a very early film from TV/children's fave director Ken Kwapis. Which is interesting.
Yeah, talked about Ken Kwapis.
Yeah.
I mean, he's so interesting to me. His wife is Marisa Silver, who is a filmmaker who I, author more so now, but filmmaker who I love. And her mother is Joan Micklin Silver. So he's part of this incredible, like, he's, you know, his mother-in-law was Joan Micklin Silver. Mm-hmm. Like, it's such an interesting filmmaking dynasty.
There's not many people who are just, like, talented children's directors. He does all sorts of stuff. It's worth saying. He's, like, one of the great TV comedy directors people don't know. A lot of The Office, a lot of Malcolm in the Middle, Bernie Mac, stuff like that. But also like this, you know, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants. Like he just kind of often wakes
Beauty
up.
And the Beautician?
Oh yeah, Beautician and the Beast.
Beautician
yeah,
the Beast.
That's a fun one.
It's in, yeah, he would have been so young.
Yes, just out of film school.
And he was essentially handpicked by Jim Henson. And Jim Henson had an incredible knack for just finding talent. And, you know, I think Ken Kwapis has kind of pointed out to Jim that, you know, I've never worked with puppets before. I've never worked with specifically puppeteers. Mm-hmm. And Jim's advice was just treat them like actors. And that's all he did. He didn't think of it as a Muppet movie, although it obviously is. And he didn't think of it as this like puppet-centric film. He treated it as a film with characters that everyone knows and loves that are real and have story arcs and personality. And I think that's why, as much as maybe you two are saying it's not super successful, to me it is.
I'm not saying it's a bad film. I want to be very clear. I just think it was received incorrectly.
Yeah.
Like
poorly, if I had to guess.
Oh yeah, I think people said it came out at a bad time. But I also think, I mean, I think if you put any modern kid down in front of it, they wouldn't pay attention to it whatsoever. It's like
the pace is
rough, and I just don't think it. I think it doesn't quite hit that appealing to adults and kids.
The other thing I think, and we've banged this on other things, is the music isn't as good.
True. They're not bad.
I don't know. What's the song? I'm So Blue. I get that stuck in my head.
It's good. And I like An Upside Down World, but that's like, but I can't, like, I can, Rainbow Connection is in my head immediately. As soon as I saw it, I'm like, bam, right?
How?
There's nothing in here.
Compare something to the Rainbow Connection.
Well, because it's also a Jim Henson related property movie. That's how you compare it. Come on.
It's one of the greatest songs ever written for film. Like, you can't all, and, you can't have films none that of all the, have a
they
connection.
Should have called
there's none
Paul
of those
Williams
here.
For yeah. this, is what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately. Didn't work much on Sesame Street. That's interesting. But you know who did work on this, which I think is hilarious, is when they were trying to find a cinematographer, they looked to the films of Peter Greenaway and specifically The Draftsman's Contract and got their cinematographer Curtis Clark from that. And I think that might be why this film looks so beautiful, is that you have Peter Greenaway's like resident cinematographer working on Sesame Street.
That's just wild. Okay, I think at that point we need to end this one. This was a good one, guys. I enjoyed this very much, and it was nice just to go and watch some. It's been quite the season with all the genre pictures, so to go into some children's genre pictures was quite nice. So Cameron Maitland, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. And I should also, I feel like people should know that the little girl who hangs out with Big Bird is played by Allison Court, who went on to be various things, including Lunette the Clown, the voice of Jubilee on X-Men, the voice of Lydia Deetz on Beetlejuice. She's Canadian children's royalty.
Royalty, yeah.
Wasn't there someone, there's another puppeteer here who met her on this,
yes,
who created
I believe the woman inside Miss Finch is the creator, yes, and also the doll puppet, yeah.
Yeah, that's just wild. All right. And Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I want to encourage everyone to watch more bird films and maybe watch out for an all bird review that I produce and curate that will include Brewster McCloud and Follow That Bird. And please send me your suggestions for what you would like to see in that retrospective.
That sounds fantastic. They didn't make a movie of the Enchanted Tiki Room yet, have they?
No, I have some horror stories related to my growing up in Anaheim and that particular section that I will save for my onstage comments during this retrospective.
All right. And you can join us in 2 weeks where we're going to get physical. It's Perfect and Heavenly Bodies. And we're going to be joined by the master of neon dreams, Brendan Ross. That's coming up in 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite On Demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Cameron Maitland and Alicia Fletcher as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.